You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Will Corwin. He's an artist in New York. Will, thanks for being with me today.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Will, let's talk about what you're working on now. What's happening in your studio, and what is your studio like? I mean, you're in New York, so I imagine it's smaller than most.
Well, my studio is kind of an odd situation. I just actually finished up an exhibition at Geary Contemporary down on Varick Street, and that was a lot of cast sculpture, and I've been working a lot with casting for the past 4 or 5 years, and I've moved into casting with lead. So the question of whether I have a studio or how big it is kind of immaterial, because in order to cast lead, one has to be outdoors. So my studio has kind of been, in one case, a mountaintop in the Catskills, and in the other case, somewhere in the Berkshires. So I've been kind of working, kind of trying to create this sort of like a mobile foundry where I can just kind of pick up and go just about anywhere and start casting sculpture. So there's a lot of prep work, which I do in my studio, which is rather small in New York, where I kind of prepare the wax pieces, and then I coat them, and then I prepare the molds, and then but then to do the actual making of the sculpture, it has to be outdoors. So primarily I work outdoors right now, but I also do a lot of work in my studio, and also I kind of travel around a lot, so I always try to be able to be very mobile and do my work on the fly wherever I am.
So let's talk about that, traveling around and doing work on the fly. This would seem like a medium that's not so easy to do that. What do you mean you travel around a lot? That's just part of your life or your work that you do? Or how do you end up traveling around so much?
Yeah, you mentioned residencies. I have done residencies in the past, but generally what I like to do is sort of find a place where there's an exhibition space or a project and go there. And then I just sort of curated and was in an exhibition in London, but I was working up in Scotland, so I had to kind of get all my sculpture supplies ready and work up not in the Scottish Highlands, but sort of in the middle of Scotland. And then before that, I was working, traveling around in Ethiopia. I was helping to curate a video festival there, and then kind of just traveling around, soaking up lots of inspiration, looking at things, doing drawings, doing recordings. A lot of my work is based on moving around and being kind of being inspired by or following a train of thought to a certain place, and then getting sort of images and symbols and objects from that place, and then bringing them back and working on them wherever it may be, if it's here in New York, or if it's upstate, or if it's somewhere else. So I kind of try to be a bit more of an itinerant artist. I don't want to be tied down to a studio practice. I had this kind of epiphany moment about 10 years ago where I was, for my own interview show, I was interviewing Sarah Lucas, and she just kind of started talking about how she hated the idea of having a studio. I mean, I'm sure she does now because she's kind of producing much bigger work. But at a certain point in her career, she said she just liked to sit at the kitchen table and be able to just make things in her house and make things wherever she went. So I found that like a very inspiring idea, which was not to be tied down to a specific studio practice anywhere. So that's kind of how I've been working for the last couple of years. And occasionally I will be given a studio from some residents here for a specific project. And that's when I can kind of hunker down and sort of start working every day in a space that's specifically set aside for this. But otherwise, it's kind of finding the space to make the specific project.
That's interesting, especially for a sculptor. That does sound like a very liberating idea that you can make work wherever you go and don't need a studio, a giant studio or something, or a boundary.
I work small. I try. I think that there's a tremendous movement over the last couple, I guess, even you could say decades in the art world to make bigger and bigger and bigger art. And a lot of my interest in art is kind of activated by much older ideas of art, of objects that were carried around that had specific meaning, amulets and small objects that were like fetish objects that were either made of extremely valuable material that were stored and hidden away and only brought out on certain days, or things that people would carry around with them. So I've always been interested in the opposite of making it big, of making it small, but like intensely meaningful in its materiality or the detail that it is, so that it's not just a giant overwhelming object, but it's more of a like a devotional object, you could say, or something like that. So that feeds into my practice of moving around a lot. This, you know, if I make smaller works, the molds are smaller, the amount of materials I need is less. And then I can focus on trying to vary different materials and do it with more sort of materials that I haven't worked with before. So instead of always working with plaster, I'm trying to work with metals now and different kind of resins and things like that to increase the acknowledgement of the materiality. So it's not just, oh, this is a typical sculptural material. This is something, oh, I can see through this, or it has this quality to it, has a certain sheen. So, or it ages in a certain way, or it clearly has a certain weight to it. Because most sculpture, there's never really an issue of picking it up or interacting with it physically, because it's usually just so big, or it's planted in the ground somewhere. So by even if people can't pick up the sculptures I make, they are a size where they can actually physically kind of wrap their heads around the idea of, well, this is a transportable object. This is a smaller piece that I can touch, that I could interact with, that I could keep somewhere. And that's part of the idea of the work.
So let's talk about what's actually happening in the work, because they're small enough that, I mean, as you're describing them, that a lot of these people can hold in their hand. As you move forward, what are the objects you're making now? Can we talk about the form of them and what objects you're choosing to cast and perhaps why?
It's actually kind of funny. I am actually moving towards a bigger object, but the I've been working on this project the last couple of weeks, which involves this very famous sculpture that was in New York at the time of the American Revolution. It was an equestrian statue of George III. And I was talking to another artist a couple of weeks ago and explaining, we were talking about materials, and he got very excited about lead, and we were talking about making projects out of lead. And this kind of energized me to pursue this project. But there was this giant sculpture of, not giant, but, you know, a large equestrian sculpture of George III in Bowling Green at the bottom of Manhattan. It was made of lead. And it always struck me as an odd material to use because, first of all, it's very heavy. And second of all, it's quite easy to manipulate. I mean, and that was one of the things on the day of the Declaration of Independence, when it was finally signed and proclaimed, this statue of George III was immediately pulled down by the colonists and melted down and made into bullets to shoot at the British. And the idea of making a sculpture that's relatively easy to pull down is sort of, it feeds into this whole philosophical idea behind making things like equestrian sculptures. Obviously, they exist to kind of show the authority and show power. And so very often they're made out of materials that are meant to withstand certain uprisings among the population. So by making this sculpture out of lead, it was actually easily pulled down with ropes and a couple horses. And then it was very easy to melt down, and it was very easy to sort of tear apart. So the idea of a sculpture that is, its materiality defeats it, was something that really intrigued me. And since I've been working with lead, you begin to make certain realizations, which is that, you know, lead is very fragile. It scratches easily. So even though it's metal, it has to be protected as a sculpture, even though very often lead is used outdoors. So it develops sort of wonderful color, and it becomes this very rich, deep kind of metallic black as it ages. The fact is that if someone comes along with a key or someone knocks it over, unlike bronze or something, it's much less stable. And so it's easily damaged. So the next big project is not like a full-size equestrian sculpture, probably more of a maquette-size one. But the idea is to create a sculpture which begins to collapse on its own, under its own weight. And so the first project I've done recently was a bust of George III. I thought I'd start small and kind of begin to put my feelers out around the subject matter and to begin to understand, you know, how he was depicted, and then to begin to play around with the ways of deforming a sculpture by pressing it down and beginning to smush it. And so eventually the idea will be to create this equestrian sculpture about quarter scale that will be designed almost so that the weight of the lead begins to force the sculpture to fall in on itself. Probably it'll have to be helped with, you know, by me pressing it down, because lead is still relatively strong, even though it is quite soft. So that's the next project. And the previous projects have all been inspired by a series of interviews I did with paleoanthropologists and archaeologists talking about the origins of creativity in human cultural production, and when did we actually start making things that we could consider art, and what were those objects, and what were they like, and how were they manufactured? So those things were sort of smaller objects that reflected those inquiries on my part.
From those interviews, you mean from the interviews, yeah, that you conducted that were, yeah, part of your really research on all of that. I mean, it's a fascinating idea of the lead sculpture, the kind of heroic sized sculpture, slowly, you know, kind of collapsing under its own weight. Because of that, is this something that, I mean, just to talk about the market a little bit, how do these get into the marketplace or the culture of the, you know, of the art world? Are they sold? Is that how it works? Or is it more installations of these that then do get destroyed or recycled? Like, what happens to your work, especially in the case of the one that you were just discussing, where the materials themselves will kind of cause their own destruction or destroy their artwork?
Well, that's a very good question. I think a couple years ago, I was doing like that kind of thing with installations that were made out of rubble that would sort of fall apart. And that was a lot of fun, and it was great to go to art spaces. I did a bunch of projects in Beijing, and I did a project at the Clock Tower Gallery when it was still down on Leonard Street, and with Shoshama here also in Midtown. And so those were fun, but yeah, as you point out, they have very little market appeal. They kind of tend to be, I think, art dealers and gallery people and nonprofit spaces like them because they are engaging. People look at them, they bring people in, and they cause people to think a lot. But you can only have so many shows like that in your roster if you're trying to run a gallery. So I did begin to focus more on stable materials. Now, the project that I just described, which is this piece that collapses in on itself, at a certain point, I think the idea is that the collapse has happened. So I think the one thing you could think of is maybe like John Chamberlain, where it'll already be smushed. So the idea is that it will have reached its point of stability, and that point of stability is the fact that of the deformation of the figure and of the shape of the object. So it would be, I think, prudent to kind of get it to a point where if it's in the gallery, it's really not going to change much. But by its form and the fact that there will be certain sort of telltale deformations, right? Like the legs of the horse will be bent in sort of unnatural ways. I mean, I've done a lot of drawings, and it's kind of fun. I mean, when I was studying physics in school, I loved to draw like vectors and show the deformation of things and the torquing and how materials change under various weights and pressures. And so it'll be obvious that that's something that's happened, but it'll be sort of a foregone, it'll be a done deal. I'm not really interested in presenting an object in the gallery that will change in front of people's eyes. I think it's more interesting for people to see the history of that change, and then to sort of, especially with something like lead, where if there was deformation, if I were going to leave it up to just natural processes, it would either be extremely fast or very, very slow. So that's not interesting in a gallery setting anyway. So part of the fun of the project is to imagine the different meanings of deforming a sculpture. I mean, it all falls back into the history of deforming sculpture, which is something I'm very interested in. When you go into the museum and you see a sculpture of Queen Hatshepsut and you notice that her nose has been broken off and her ritual beard has been knocked off and her hands have been broken. And you look at Greek sculptures and you notice, or Greek and Roman sculptures, that the noses or the genitalia have been knocked off. I mean, I think traditionally people look at those and just attribute it to the damage over time, but actually very often they were conscious destructive acts by people to render sculptures, like sort of remove the power from a sculpture by damaging it in a very specific way. And traditionally in the Roman period, knocking the genitalia off of a sculpture was very, seems very obvious that would be a way of kind of destroying a sculpture and also removing its meaning from it and emasculating it both physically and metaphorically. And so the idea of deforming a sculpture in this case is more about the philosophy behind it than some kind of like natural mechanism. I mean, the lead lends itself very well to that. And then the lead also is very symbolic of that because it's a material that's very unstable. It's the last element in the periodic table before elements become radioactive. So it's right on the cusp of like instability. And I like the idea of playing with it and using it to create a philosophical point by deforming it in a way that it kind of naturally lends itself to.
So I love that idea, and it seems like such an interesting thing to keep working on. So you know, as you were saying, it could kind of melt into a kind of Chamberlain-like looking piece. But what do you find so far? And what I'm really asking is kind of the context in how you're creating. It doesn't seem like these are providing you with a living. You're represented in a gallery in New York, and you're having regular shows. But are sales of these something that you're not concerned with? Is that not really part of what you're looking for?
Sales would be great. I'm absolutely looking for sales. That would be wonderful. At this point, I'm just trying to sort of pursue certain ideas and to engage in a dialogue with other sculptors around me and other artists around me. On one hand, galleries exist to promote that dialogue. On the other hand, they exist to make some money. So certainly the objects are made with the idea that they could be placed somewhere. You know, they could be in someone's home. They are meant to be objects that reflect objects from very long ago when people kind of integrated sculpture into their lives in a way that was very, very normative and not all about collecting a work and how much cultural capital it represented for you. I mean, when you go, I spend a lot of time talking to archaeologists, and when they go through ruins and when they go through the ruins of cities and towns, very often they find small sculptures that people kept in their houses, and it's the same idea as the, like the Madonna of Guadalupe or having like a Ganesh in your house. This is the idea of integrating sculpture into your life in a way that that it's part of the everyday experience. And that's something that I think is kind of lacking in a lot of contemporary society. And in past projects, I've looked at certain things that I think people ignore, or they just kind of, they think it's something other than what it is. Like there's a famous manifestation of this wonderful kind of sculpture that you find in a lot of neighborhoods in like Staten Island or Bensonhurst, or where it's the bathtub Madonna, it's the St. Francis, and people would take like half a bathtub and use it as a little sort of archway to place the Madonna, and they put it on their lawn, and most people just kind of drive by that or walk by that and think it's sort of like a tacky object equivalent to like a garden gnome or something. But actually, obviously, it's a very pure and sort of sincere evocation of faith. And people don't even stop to think, well, that's actually a sculpture being used in the way that sculpture was kind of originally intended to be used, which was as this like devotional object, or as this object that you would use as a focal point for your spiritual thoughts or just the way that you thought the cosmos worked. And so it would be great to get sculpture into people's houses. It would be great to get my sculpture into people's collections. I'm certainly not opposed to that, and I'm actually very enthusiastic about it. But for the meantime, I just kind of am following my own path, and exhibiting, and occasionally there's a sale now and again, and that's great. So, but the idea of like forcefully pushing the commercial aspect, I think I actually prefer to be much more philosophical about the work, and then you hope that there's a collector out there who listens to the story and is someone who is really interested in the idea of the spirituality of sculpture. And, you know, and obviously I'm not ignoring the aesthetics either. I mean, you want it to look beautiful. You want it to be something that is harmonious with, you know, the world around it. I'm not trying to make like shocking, horrifying objects. The intention is not to make something that is not saleable.
Right. And so what else happens in your life? Are you teaching or doing other things that
I do your work? I do a lot of curating. I just curated this exhibition in London called I, Cyborg, which was a continuation of an exhibition that was done in New York at the Zurcher Gallery. But the current exhibition is at it's at the Gazelli Art House on Dover Street. You can see it until November 12th. And it's a group show, and it pursues a lot of like the ideas that I've been working with like the origins of art and the representation of the body and contemporary art, looking at scientific ideas, like the changes in the body and how like evolution is like just ideas about evolution, things like that. So the curation is one thing. I'm curating another show of Conrad Venture's photographs at the Baxter Street Gallery on Baxter Street, which is part of the Camera Club of New York. That's actually opening on November 2nd. So I do a lot of work curating, which I think means just you sit down with an artist, you talk about their ideas, or you pitch an idea to an art gallery or an art space, and then usually there's a budget, so that obviously helps support the work. I do a lot of writing. I write for the Brooklyn Rail. I write for Freeze occasionally. I write for Art Papers and Art Critical. And then I do the show on the radio for Clock Tower. So and then occasionally there's a bit of teaching too, but so I guess you could, it's like a quite a diverse.
That's what I wanted. All those things in there, because I knew you did a lot of those, but without mentioning them,
right? Yeah,
doing all kinds of things, you know. As well, I'm glad we focus on the sculpture, but these are all your activities outside that, which I of course relate to in a number of personal ways, but as well as the. You know, all these projects that you're doing. And maybe I interrupted you. There was writing, there's the Clock Tower, and you were maybe going to say something else. Or maybe
Right now it's a lot of writing and curating. And it's great because the curation is, if it's not just specifically working with an artist who comes to you and says, I need to do a show and I just want some sort of help organizing things, which is really fun because you get to know an artist's work. And in this case, Conrad's project is absolutely fascinating. He's been photographing and videoing the remaining Andy Warhol superstars. And in this exhibition, he's looking at Ivy Nicholson, who's one of the earliest ones, and kind of recording her life, which is, I mean, she had one of the most amazing rags to riches to rags lives you could imagine. And so I've been working with him and just sort of trying to get the narrative out there and to talk about the work and to present it and to help an artist just to show their work in a way that makes their ideas clear and accessible to everyone. And then the other side of the creating is to just follow these ideas that I've been working with for a couple of years now, like the archaeology, discussions with archaeologists. And also a lot of it comes out of my interviews with artists in general is that I'll talk to a couple artists over a few months and I'll notice some sort of similarities in what they're doing. And it also then kind of feeds back into like what I'm doing in my own practice. And I realize that there's some kind of a underlying, you know, there's some kind of a subtext that's going on that I think is very interesting among artists. And so I'll try and bring all those artists together, choose the pieces that seem to represent this line of thinking and do an exhibition, which is how the Cyborg show came about. It was about artists working with the human body, but instead of looking at the human body in the sort of Vitruvian way, the idea of the human body is like a perfect object, a lot of artists are kind of beginning to look at the human body as not the end point in the evolutionary process by any means, but also a body that is beginning to be added onto, either in terms of like prosthesis or replacement organs or by interacting with architecture in a new way where the body and the architecture are kind of beginning to flow together, or even in terms of like, you know, interactions between human beings and like the environment and vegetation and beginning to understand the rhythms of the world that we work, that we live in, that we have to begin to work with in order to create a functioning planet. So, it's all these ideas that sort of are coming around and make for really interesting shows, and I don't necessarily choose artists because they're obsessed with like technology or the environment or something, but very often certain artists are working with these ideas, and when you bring them all together, you see all these disparate people working in very, very different practices, from painting to animation to fabric to traditional sculpture or casting. And you get a show that really kind of evokes a spirit of the time. So that's been a lot of the work that I'm doing right now.
And when you talk about that, I mean, that kind of really wraps it all up, and I'm glad you mentioned all of that, because we could talk more about the interviews and a number of things, but just to touch on, when you say you begin to work with an artist or an artist shows you work and you really like that because then you help build the narrative and get it out there, is that something more of a collaboration between you two, or is that something artists seek you out for? I mean, I'm talking about how you're working as a curator, but you know, I'm sure there's plenty of artists who think, well, yeah, I'd like to work with Will on one thing or another. Do people just simply reach out to you and say, are you interested in this work, and would you like to help me develop a narrative and get it out there?
In the case of Conrad, he kind of reached out. He knew that I kind of got what he was trying to do, and I'd seen him do a show with Elizabeth Clay at Regina Rex, where her ceramics were on display, her ceramic cages were on display with his photographs of Mario Montez, the great Andy Warhol superstar and a great transvestite performer. And he could tell that I got the work and I really liked it. And so I don't know if I'd call it a collaboration. I would never kind of assume that. I would say that you know, I'm trying to just, a lot of artists are, you know, they are not in their own world, but their ability to, I mean, it's true of all of us, whatever our chosen line of work, very often we're so caught up in it that we don't realize that half the things that we say in our head, and the other half people don't always understand. So sometimes it helps just to have an outside person to bounce some ideas against, and then also that person can say, I don't get it, what are you talking about? And then they can say, oh, well, no, this actually refers to this story or this idea that I was thinking of. And then it's much easier when someone else can pull that information out of an artist or a writer or a thinker and get them to express themselves, and then you can present it to the public or to an audience in a way that you fill in all the blanks. So I think it's less of a collaboration and more of just kind of advising and advice. And then the bigger shows are generally just like an idea that I had. And a lot of the artists are, sometimes they kind of, they get it and they're like, yeah, I'm really interested into that idea. Sometimes they say, well, I don't know what I have to do with cyborgs. I'm a ceramic artist, or I'm a dancer, or, you know, I do something completely different. But some of them immediately are like, yeah, I get this idea that I'm that's flowing through my work. So very often it's fine with other projects. It's finding the ideas that are kind of latent in the artist's work, that they just exist in their time. They're soaking up all this stimulus from around them, and they're evoking these ideas, and they're there. And once you kind of point it out and you say, well, did you think about this? And they say, oh yeah, okay. So definitely. So there are two kinds of curating. So one is this kind of collecting and collaging of ideas and images. And the other, I think, is kind of just working with artists. And you know, I did one show where I wrote an essay about something. I sent it to the about 35 artists. And I said, have you ever made anything that makes you that this essay makes you think about? And if you have, would you put it in the show? And we, you know, everyone contributed, and we had an amazing show. It was all about diagrams and summoning demons and angels and things, and how do you work with diagrams? And it was a great show, and we had, you know, we had all these different artists, from Sarah Lucas to Roxy Payne, talking about this idea of diagramming and this idea of like trying to somehow channel some kind of energy through their work. So very often I try to leave it up to the artist in many cases, sometimes not, but you know, it's all over the place.
I'm so glad we talked about all that as well. It's great talking to you. The question I want to ask before we go is there a book or books you're reading at the moment? I've been asking people that lately. So if there's a book that you'd like to share with us, I'd love to hear about what you're reading.
Well, there are a couple, actually. I think the one that I've been reading sort of regularly on the subway is Patti Smith, Just Kids, which is about her life in New York in the 60s with Robert Mapplethorpe, which is just sort of an incredibly touching, beautifully written story. It's almost like a fairy tale. I mean, obviously it's like a very sad fairy tale, but it's this like beautiful story of like two kids living in New York, and how, you know, there's a certain time in your life when things are just really beautiful and fun, and there's not a lot of responsibility, so you can try and do different things. And then I've been reading two other like history books. One is by a friend of mine named Minu Dinshaw, called Outlandish Night, which is it's a biography of this historian named Stephen Runciman. And that's like really thickly well-researched, like every detail of this guy's life. And it's quite fascinating to sort of to read biography. I always find it amazing to like find the little details and Minu is very good at like taking one idea and linking it to another. So it'll be, you know, he'll be wearing a certain piece of clothing or he'll have a conversation with someone at a dinner party and then that'll somehow slowly roll its way into an adventure in Romania. And then he writes a book about, you know, Byzantine history and how Romania was involved. So he kind of connects all these things in a wonderful way. And then the third book I've started is by another friend of mine named Norman Ohler, and it's called Blitzed. And it's this amazing book about drug use in the Third Reich. And I mean, I didn't know that like the Nazis had invented crystal meth and that they fed it to the German army during the Blitzkrieg of France so that the German army could march for 2 days nonstop. So it's kind of all about the origins of drug use in modern warfare and how then eventually, you know, the United States Army uses a lot of amphetamines to keep the troops going. So it's this kind of another history book, but very dark. That one in particular is pretty dark.
Well, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Brainerd. It's been great.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.